call the doctor.
Victor Pinamonte Lopez and Carol Clark, John C. Kianaga for the appellant, Mark R. Harry, Attorney General, Robert A. Daniels for the third, senior Attorney General.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Kionaga for Mr. Velasquez Lopez. Your Honors, the question is whether or not trial counsel acted in an objectively reasonable manner when she failed to perfect the appeal of Mr. Velasquez. Flores requires that counsel's choices be reasonable. Reasonableness is informed by context, and there are several aspects that are undeniable in the context of the case. First, we have an accused who is a man of very limited intellectual resources and difficulty understanding. There was an unopposed motion to evaluate him for competence. The defense expert found him to be incompetent. The Commonwealth expert found him to be competent, just. The court, adjudged him to be competent to proceed to trial, but made a special point of noting that he needed considerable time with counsel and with an interpreter, and authorized additional hours for both. Mr. Velasquez is a native of El Salvador, doesn't speak English, illiterate in his native language. He completed 1 year of school in El Salvador. The second aspect of the concept of the context, which is undeniable, is Mr. Lopez, Velasquez Lopez's very clear desire to see his matter appealed. He wrote multiple letters to the court and to his counsel. He used different terms. He said he was unhappy with the result. He said he wanted to reopen. He said he wanted to appeal. But this is not a case where the wisdom of an appeal was ever called into question. His counsel never sat down with him and argued the risks of perhaps a greater sentence or greater prejudice to him. None of that ever happened.
Counsel, may I ask you this? The trial court found as a factual matter, in sitting as a fact finder after hearing the witnesses, that the defendant did not ask this counsel to pursue an appeal, and in fact the opposite, instructed her not to. What are we to make of that?
That finding, Your Honors, is plainly wrong, given the undeniable context of the case.
So for you to win the appeal, do you concede that you have to have that ruling that the factual finding was plainly wrong in order to...
I do not concede that, Your Honor, but what I'm saying before the court today is that the record, when viewed clearly, establishes without question that Mr. Velasquez wanted his case appealed. There was some confusion. He talked about reopening, and then he talked about a new counsel. His brother said, we've hired new counsel, but we'd like to know
the sake of argument. Suppose for the sake of argument the trial judge is right, and your client specifically instructed this lawyer not to pursue the appeal. Just for the sake of argument, conceding nothing, what would be left of the habeas argument?
Your Honor, were the fact to be found that Mr. Velasquez specifically instructed that he did not want an appeal, then certainly trial counsel was not obligated to proceed with one, assuming there had been proper consultation beforehand. But that is not the position we're taking. We're taking the position that he did instruct her to appeal, and that wish was undeniably clear. The other aspect of the context which is undeniable is that trial counsel had an obligation, statutory and constitutional, to perfect the appeal.
Counsel, are you drawing a distinction between he clearly wanted an appeal and whether he instructed her to not file an appeal? Are you saying that the facts are clear that he instructed her to file an appeal?
I'm saying that the facts are clear that he wanted his case appealed.
Okay.
Are the facts clear that he wanted his case appealed by her, who was his counsel of record?
They are not, Your Honor, but it's clear that he wanted the case appealed by somebody. He said he wanted it reopened. He was unhappy with the sentence.
So we go back to Justice Kelsey's question. If he wanted his case appealed, but he instructs her not to file it, not to file the appeal, where does that leave us?
Your Honor, if you're dealing with a client who's intellectually limited, who makes clear on the one hand that he wants an appeal and then says he wants somebody else to file it, I would submit that it falls to counsel who's appointed, who has an obligation to see that the right to appeal is perfected, is preserved and perfected, to make sure that the appeal goes forward. Trial counsel was obligated to pursue the appeal until she was either relieved by the court or replaced, and neither one happened. And the Commonwealth makes a rather empty point that the court never told her she was specifically that she was obligated to pursue the appeal. That's a matter of constitution and a matter of statute in this state. But I think the idea of parsing words and trying to extrapolate from the communications in this case that he instructed her not to file his appeal is a red herring, and it does not do justice to Mr. Velasquez's right to counsel and his right to appeal. He told her and he told the court that he was not happy. He wanted the case reopened. Whether he used the term reopen or appeal is immaterial. That's a distinction a lot of native-born laymen can't understand. Appeal is a term of art. But to allow the trial counsel to divest herself of her duty by seeking shelter behind the very labored conclusion that he directed her not to file an appeal, I think completely denudes Mr. Velasquez of the constitutional protections to which he's entitled.
Had she been appointed appellate counsel, specifically appointed as appellate counsel?
Your Honor, to the extent that appointed trial counsel is responsible for the appeal. That's a matter of statute and a matter of the standards of indigent defense. It's very clear that appointed counsel is responsible for any appeal. And
it's your position that she was counsel of record until a court told her through an order that she was no longer counsel of record.
Absolutely.
Is that right? And as long as she was counsel of record, she had a responsibility to see to it that the appeal was perfected by her or somebody else.
Correct, Your Honor. If somebody else had come in and actually entered an appearance, then she would have been free of any further obligation. But I assume most of Your Honors have been trial court judges. The entry of appearance and substituting counsel is a matter that's taken very seriously. It's almost always done in writing. It's certainly done unambiguously. You don't get people kind of drifting in and out of the court. One counsel is responsible for the welfare of the client, and if the counsel is appointed, then that responsibility transcends the actual trial stage and goes into the appeal stage. And it's undeniable, it's unambiguous, that if a wish to appeal is is articulated, it needs to be honored and acted on. Trial counsel could have gone to the court and said, Your Honor, he clearly wants his case reexamined. I don't think he's happy with me. Could you appoint somebody else? There's an absolute dearth of any documentation as to his supposed wish that he not appeal. He wrote a letter to her saying he was unhappy. He wrote a letter to the court saying he was unhappy, wanted the case reopened. She goes to visit him at jail without an interpreter, and the next day notes an appeal. How clear could his instruction that he didn't want her to appeal have been if very next day...
Is your argument before us that he's entitled to habeas relief because of a constitutional violation, or he's entitled to habeas relief because of a 19-2-159 violation?
Both, Your Honor.
Did you raise the 19-2-159 violation before us or before the...
Your Honor, I raised it in the habeas petition, but the brief before this court refers to a statutory right to appellate counsel in the person of the trial counsel.
So
So it's been amply pled. Certainly there's no danger that the circuit court had to is being ambushed by an appeal on an issue that was not disclosed to the circuit court. It was very clearly disclosed and acted upon.
Counsel, I keep coming back to Justice Kelsey's question, and you keep using the word clear, but the court, in fact, said appellant, quote, had clearly conveyed his wishes that he did not want her to file an appeal for him. And so in light of that, what do you think counsel should have done? File the appeal anyway?
Well, counsel clearly recognized, counsel noted the appeal.
Right.
Because
filed a notice. Right.
So whatever transpired in that meeting at the jail, whatever measure of communication was able to pass between them without an interpreter, she came away, trial counsel came away persuaded that she should file the appeal. But given the statutory and constitutional requirement, the responsibility to preserve the appeal right, the very least trial counsel should have done, if not actually filed a brief, was to bring to the court's attention any perceived lack of clarity and seek the court's guidance. You don't simply forget the matter and wait for somebody else to show up and then decide you're no longer responsible for it if that person doesn't show up. I mean, imagine a soldier that's sent out to guard a bridgehead and his company commander says, you'll be relieved in the morning. Noon the next day comes, he looks at his watch and says, oh, nobody's here, he leaves.
Okay, we're not dealing with soldiers, we're dealing with attorneys. And what we've got is a client who says, I don't want you to pursue my appeal. My brothers have got me a new lawyer, and I want to appeal. But where's the lack of clarity?
Your Honor, first of all, in terms of soldiers versus lawyers, we just heard the remarks to the new lawyers. This is a profession. The profession involves duty and oath. So there are definite parallels between the two professions. But, Your Honor, the most important communication that Mr. Lopez made was that he wanted the case reexamined, whatever terminology he used. He was repeatedly, unambiguously clear about that. The fact that he said, my brothers have gotten another lawyer, please give him the file, does not divest trial counsel of opportunity. That file belongs to her. The future of that case belongs to her unless and until she is either relieved by the court or replaced. Her decision to sit silently and allow the time to lapse was a violation of her duty to that client, statutory and constitutional. It would have been a matter of no great burden to simply pen a motion to the court seeking clarification or saying, he wants to appeal, but he's not happy with me. Please appoint new counsel. That happens all the time. Instead, she was distracted, she was lazy, she was irritated, who knows? She did nothing, and that's unacceptable. You can't simply allow somebody's appeal right to lapse because there's been a mention of another attorney. Trial attorneys, counselors, and courts deal with this all the time.
You're right. You can't allow that to happen, but you may have an ethical duty to do something further. You may have a duty as an officer of the court to bring it to the court, appointing court's attention. But the question, at least under Strickland, is whether or not the Sixth Amendment requires a lawyer who's told not to pursue an appeal to nonetheless defy the instructions of the client and pursue an appeal. That seems rather anomalous to me, and I didn't see any authority in your brief for that proposition.
Your Honor, I don't think there is a case that specifically meets, at least I wasn't able to find one, that specifically meets the facts of this case. Strickland, Flores, they're talking about the articulated desire to have an appeal. Clearly we have that here, regardless of the terminology he used. Given that he articulated clearly the desire to have an appeal, it was incumbent on trial counsel to protect that right and to perfect it. The idea that he says, I want somebody else to do it, counsel and clients have friction and disagreements all the time, particularly for criminal defense counsel. That's all I do, and it's a fact of my life all the time. That doesn't mean you get to step back and say, I'm done with you. You still have a duty to proceed.
And what about when your client says, I'm done with you?
Your Honor, this has happened to me, actually. And I'll say, you're done with me when you hire somebody to replace me, or the court appoints somebody else.
My brothers have done so.
I'm sorry?
My brothers have done so. I'm very done with you.
They have to come in and enter their appearance. This is a common scenario in court where
the
people...
The case of Smith versus White says that the failure to comply with the statute cannot be reached by a writ of habeas corpus. How do you use, in light of that, how do you use 19-2 to argue that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
The case of Smith versus White says the failure to comply with the statute cannot be reached by a writ of habeas corpus.
Your Honor, I don't recall that case, but the fact of the matter is this obligation was a function of a statutory and a constitutional right. The right to pursue an appeal is well established as a matter of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of due process in the jurisprudence of this state and also in the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument.
Good morning, may it please the court, Robert Anderson for the director. If I could just try to make three or four quick points at the outset, hopefully I'll remember them all. First, this attorney, I think that's very unfair to her to characterize her as distracted and lazy and doing nothing. I mean, she filed a notice of appeal simply to keep his appellate rights open. I mean, the letter opinion of the lower court essentially found as fact that she filed the notice of appeal for that reason.
Did substitute counsel ever enter an appearance?
I don't think so. I don't think there's
Did she ever transfer the file to substitute counsel?
No one ever showed up as per the representations that they would. So she filed a notice of appeal, and I don't think the record reflects that from that point on anything was filed in the circuit court in the period of time where an appeal still might lie. And then, so the next thing that happened was the Court of Appeals several months later, January 28th of 2011, dismissed the appeal for failure to perfect a petition for appeal. Now, counsel, I think that the two critical things here are, one, the finding of fact that Justice Kelsey and I think a couple of other justices have alluded to, where the lower court, having conducted an evidentiary hearing, found this fact. This is at page 259 of the appendix, very bottom of that page. Here, the question under the first prong of Strickland was whether counsel was deficient for failing to file a petition for appeal when the defendant, petitioner herein, had clearly conveyed his wishes that he did not want her to file an appeal for him. And it goes on, counsel, the latter opinion goes on to say counsel was not deficient for failing to file a petition for appeal. I submit that unless and until the court finds that finding of fact clearly erroneous or not fairly supported by the record, that's the end of the case, because then we turn to the seminal case in this area, Roe versus Flores-Ortega. And the Supreme Court in that case talked about basically these two polar opposites. One, which later showed up in this court's decision in the Miles case, was one where the court said, we have long held that a lawyer who disregards specific instructions from the defendant to file a notice of appeal acts in a manner that is professionally unreasonable. And that was the basis for this court's decision in Miles, holding that the petitioner had been denied his right to appeal. At the other end of the spectrum, the court said, a defendant who explicitly tells his attorney not to file an appeal plainly cannot later complain that by following his instructions, his counsel performed efficiently. I submit that that's what we have here as per the finding of fact. The counsel made some reference about there not having been a consultation about the pros and cons of an appeal, but given the finding of fact, this consultation aspect of Flores-Ortega sort of falls by the wayside, because the Supreme Court says quite clearly in that case, quote, in those cases where the defendant neither instructs counsel to file an appeal nor asks that an appeal not be taken, We believe the question whether counsel has performed efficiently by not filing a notice of appeal is best answered by a separate but antecedent question, whether counsel in fact consulted with the defendant about an appeal. The point is, if you have either of those two polar extremes, then you don't get to the matter of consultation.
Let me ask you this. What about the instance where the defendant says, I want to file an appeal, but I don't want you to do it?
Well, then I think that that is the Flores-Ortega polar extreme, where he says, I don't want you to file an appeal for me.
But I want to file an appeal, and I speak a different language, and I don't have any money.
Well, in this case, the attorney filed a timely notice of appeal to keep the appellate rights open, and she was told right at the time she's doing that, just have that paperwork handy because the new lawyers are going to get the paperwork. Also,
then what happens when the new lawyers don't show up and you know the deadline is
extended?
Well,
then if you, under Flores-Ortega, that's imputable to the petitioner who gave the attorney her marching orders, not to her. I would, on this issue of the factual finding and whether it's correct, if I could point the court to, let's see, where is this? Just bear with me a second. This is at page 252 of the appendix. She receives a letter, in English, by the way, and there's no evidence. According to the attorney, this was about a year-long process, and according to the attorney, this defendant's understanding of the legal process continued to get sharper, and his questions became more sophisticated, and his skills in English improved in the course of the year or so, year plus. This letter from October 4th is in English. I don't think there's anything in the record to indicate that it was composed by someone else after he spoke in Spanish, but it says right there in the letter, talking about his brothers, they want to appeal my case, but we need you to open the case so another attorney can do something for me. Even more important, right below that, there's a handwritten notation, 10-6-10, by the attorney alleged to be ineffective. Visited JCVL at Culpeper Jail. Informed he did not in caps and underline, want me to file an appeal for him. That is about as unqualified a statement as one could imagine. It's hard to see how this factual finding could be deemed so misguided as to be set aside on appeal. She also said categorically.
Let me ask a question, if I may. What if, let's just assume a hypothetical, that she's court-appointed counsel and they're going to trial. And her client says, I'm going to plead not guilty on my trial next month, but I don't want you as my lawyer. My brothers are going to get me another lawyer. Don't be my lawyer.
For the trial?
For the trial. Can she just not show up?
No, I think under those circumstances where she's been appointed and the trial is pending, I think that, I suppose in theory she could write the court in advance and say, I've been told X, Y, and Z, and I'm not sure I should show up. But I think
Isn't that what appellant's counsel said she should have done in this case?
Well, he may have said it, but Flores-Ortega says that that's not good enough. Flores-Ortega could not say in more unqualified language, if the petitioner or defendant says, I don't want you to file an appeal, you're not ineffective for not filing an appeal. That trumps any kind of variation of facts that I can think of.
Was Flores-Ortega that the defendant wanted to appeal but did not want this lawyer to appeal? Or that
no.
He didn't want to appeal at all?
No, Flores-Ortega, having set out the two polar extremes where it's one either plainly incumbent upon the attorney to file an appeal or two, it's plainly incumbent upon him or her not to, for the most part dealt with, by its own description, dealt with a situation where it was not quite so clear what the defendant's wishes were. And it was in that in-between murkier area that the Supreme Court dealt with things such as the need to consult. But it quite clearly, if you have the two extremes of clarity, then the decision it basically articulated dealt with other circumstances. I submit that those circumstances are not posed here. It's important to note the attorney himself today several times says quite clearly the defendant wanted to appeal. He clearly conveyed his desire to appeal. And that there's reference to reopening the case versus an appeal is of no consequence. So, and his habeas petition was to the same effect. So these assertions about his being from El Salvador and not having much legal knowledge basically are of very little consequence, given his own description that he said he wanted to appeal. Further, counsel seems to base this argument on both constitutional and statutory grounds. I submit for several reasons that is not a proper basis for finding this attorney was ineffective. First, in the counsel-filed petition, there was an amended petition in the circuit court. So because it was counsel-filed, there's no need or justification for construing it liberally. Page 101 of the appendix. Petitioner was deprived of his right to effective assistance under the Sixth Amendment. That's a constitutional claim governed by Strickland and Flores Ortega. He says at page 1 of his brief in this court that this appeal, first paragraph, this appeal concerns the failure of Mr. Vasquez Lopez's appointed counsel to perfect his appeal despite a statutory obligation to do so. I submit that if the attorney's performance here complied with the constitutional requirements applicable under Strickland and Flores Ortega, and if it's a constitutional claim, that's the end of the issue. And I would give several reasons for that. First of all, there was a reference to Section 19.2159 in the circuit court, but it was never on brief. There was just literally a reference to some statutory right. If it had been discussed in the brief, I might have had something to say about it. And by the same token, there's a reference to indigent standards or standards governing indigent defendants. That was never, ever mentioned in the lower court. But as to the crux of the matter, Strickland, which concerned the effectiveness or lack of it, of an attorney in a death penalty case, referred to some ABA standards, and they basically said, in so many words, they're not controlling, they're only guides. And then Flores Ortega quoted that same language from Strickland and said, we're concerned with the Sixth Amendment obligations. By the way, and this is something it's easy to lose sight, when in fact I've sort of halfway forgotten it myself, I think it's very, I'm sure everyone on the court is well familiar with the principle that on a trial attorney alleged to be ineffective, that there's a heavy deferential standard governing his or her decisions or omissions. Well, Flores Ortega makes quite clear that that same deferential standard applies to the actions of an attorney. So, in this particular case, one last thing on Flores Ortega, which is important. As I say, Flores Ortega quoted the language from Strickland about the fact that these professional norms, these guides, they're not irrelevant, but they're not controlling, and the fact that you can't simply say, well, you didn't comply with state standard X, and therefore you're ineffective under the Sixth Amendment. It's very instructive that in Flores Ortega, in the cases that they concerned themselves, that murky area where there weren't the two polar extremes, rejected the dissent's assertion that there should be either a per se or a virtually per se obligation on the part of counsel to discuss with the defendant a possible appeal. What's interesting is that Justice Souter, in his dissent, who, by the way, talked in very similar terms about the background of the defendant as what we've heard here today about this particular defendant, he noted that California had a statute that basically there was an affirmative duty of counsel to discuss a possible appeal. If that was a statute, we're not talking about indigent standards. If that statute...
The whole point is the Sixth Amendment doesn't depend on rules of professional responsibility. We can change those tomorrow.
Right, and statutes presumably are even higher up the food chain than some ABA standards. This is a California statute said you have an affirmative duty to discuss appeals. The majority found that to be so inconsequential it didn't even mention it. I don't see how there's any basis for a different result here. I submit that the factual finding is amply supported by the record in this case. If the finding of fact is enforced or applied here, I submit under Flores-Ortega, the attorney plainly was not ineffective, but the attorney who was conscientious enough to the point that she filed a timely notice of appeal. I'd ask the court to affirm.
Call the next case.
Your Honor,